Thanks for tuning in. From Municipal World, I'm Susan Gardner. This is the MW Shares podcast, where we share your stories, providing insights into the challenges and opportunities facing local governments and communities just like yours. This episode of MW Shares is sponsored by TELUS IoT and TELUS Smart Traffic Solutions. Thanks for joining us for another episode of MW Shares. Our guest today is Ashley Whedon. Ashley is a rural futurist and PhD candidate in the School of Environmental Design and Rural Development in the Ontario Agricultural College at the University of Guelph. Her work is focused on investigating place-based rural innovation, community capacity building, and public policy renewal. She is a strong advocate for people-centered, responsive public policy and connectivity-driven innovation. And you can read her column, Connecting the Dots, every month in Municipal World magazine. She's joining us today to talk about the triumphs and failures of evidence-based policymaking. Welcome, Ash.
Hey, it's good to be here. Well, be here virtually, in the very least, in this brave new world.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you could join us today to talk about this. It's an important topic. It's coming out of a conversation that you and I recently had, talking about some of the challenges we've seen around policymaking in recent weeks and the various measures that different governments and officials and agencies have kind of grappled with during the pandemic. So we're going to dig in deep on that today for folks. Let's kick it off by talking about this question as a foundation. Why is evidence-based policymaking important, particularly during a time like this?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get real nerdy on folks here, right? So this is like the deep nerd work of doing government, right, is policymaking. And I think that it's really interesting to kind of chart a lot of, you know, where does evidence-based policy, where does the idea for it come from, and how does it get applied, and what's all wrapped into that. And, you know, I'm going to start right out of the gate to say, like, I'm not a public health expert. I'm not a health policy expert or anything, but I am somebody that's worked across a variety of public policy, you know, kind of portfolios, and all with varying degrees of, you know, kind of jumping out the window and building the plane on the way down. And right now we're, you know, societal wise, we have leapt out of a very, very tall building. You know, we're kind of skydiving here and trying to figure out how to build all of our safety equipment on the way down. And so I want to kind of start out by saying, you know, there are a number of ways in which we've leaned into the evidence, right? You know, early on in the pandemic, one of the markers of why Canada has seen so much success in terms of kind of flattening the curve and being able to mitigate some of the worst potential outcomes of the virus of COVID-19 was that we listened to sort of expert advice right out of the hopper, right? The deference to our medical experts and public health experts across the country is really a hallmark of why evidence-based policy matters, right? So we're looking towards those people that have a depth of experience and knowledge and insight and who are aware of kind of the emerging trends and information about new phenomenon. And we all kind of collectively as a country turned to them and said, well, now what? You know, like what do we need to know and how do we navigate this kind of thing during a time of tremendous uncertainty? So I think, you know, maybe broadly we have a desire to listen to experts on those kinds of portfolios. But what we're starting to see now is where that kind of chafes a little bit. How does evidence become developed? How does it get into the policy process? And I think, you know, a really good example of this, and Sue and I, you and I were talking about this, is the mask debate is a really interesting one, because most of us aren't going to be, other than once we leave kind of, you know, grade 12 chemistry, won't be involved in the scientific process or scientific method.
Mercifully.
No more frog dissections. I that wasn't my jam either. I'm a social scientist. I do people. And I don't dissect them. Let's like clarify
no
that.
Off the,
no dissections off the bat. So most people won't be involved in this process where those of us who are engaged in research of any variety over time know that you learn. It's an engaged process of learning. So one of the interesting things that we're seeing right now is this tension that seems to have built up, you know, kind of socially, politically around learning new things and changing your mind is seen quite negatively rather than part of the process of developing that better evidence. So, you know, early on, you know, we had Dr. Tam and we had lots of experts saying, you know, they weren't sold on the conclusiveness of the usefulness of masks, but new evidence, as we learn more about COVID-19, as we learn more about how to engage in safer socialization or working, we found that masks are quite, you know, much more effective than we thought, and certainly better than no masks. And so instead of viewing that as a natural progression of how we learn about things and develop what is actually evidence, we're getting some interesting pushback happening across kind of all jurisdictions around, well, it's confusing, or you changed your mind. And I think part of that is the real-time process that people are seeing around this thing. And we take it for granted, right? We take it for granted how this evidence base gets stored up, because CBC Edmonton, I think, posted a really fascinating video of some archival footage that they had done interviews with folks in, I think, like 1987, when the seatbelt legislation came into effect. And people were saying kind of this exact same language where no one can tell me what to do. I'm going to get a medical note saying I don't need to wear a seatbelt. You know, I'm not sold on this evidence. I've been driving my whole life this way and it's been perfectly fine. And so this kind of resistance to something, whereas now, like, I'm, you know, I would have been a year old in 1987. The idea of not wearing a seatbelt is, you know, bananas to me. It's totally foreign. But we forget that that's a relatively short period of time to go from this was new evidence and something we should be doing to just a thing that's taken as a given. The challenge we're in right now is that that's happening very quickly, right? So we have a new phenomenon that's happening, where it's happening in the context of broader social and economic systems that were, you know, kind of chugging down in one direction as they were. And so rather than looking at that as like a 30-year arc to adapt to new evidence, we're asking our communities and we're asking people to adapt to new evidence as it emerges, almost on a week-by-week basis.
Sometimes in days, in fact.
Sometimes, yeah. It's almost hourly, right? Like in the early days of this, it felt like every time you turned on the news, there was something new and you just kind of, oh my gosh, you know, it was whiplash from trying to keep it up to speed. And that's as us, you people are consuming that information, and I can only imagine, you know, I look with great admiration and deep respect to our public health leaders who have rolled with this new evidence as it comes out so rapidly. But it's really interesting to me that what is actually fundamentally learning, something that we claim to espouse as a value, you know, socially, that we want, you know, we want kids to go to school and learn and we want to grow and develop as professionals. But when it comes to engaging in a thing that maybe runs up against something that creates some cognitive dissonance for us, or is happening rather quickly, that willingness to say, okay, well, part of learning is saying, I knew this is what I thought, then I learned something new, and now I think something different, is being politicized in a really, I think, dangerous way. But also speaks to this broader arc of how challenging it is to build evidence into making responsive policy.
So we know that, you know, from a political level, elected leaders will often draw criticism for, I mean, outside of the circumstances of this pandemic, to, you know, have made a decision on something and then, you know, to go back and revisit and say, you know, maybe we should look at this again. And they often draw criticism for this, you know, it's perceived as a flip-flop of sorts. So is there a connection between this and, you know, this intersectionality now? We've had our politicians deferring, you know. It was wonderful, actually, to see this, you know, in the earliest days, elected leaders saying, we're going to defer to, you know, what our health people are saying, what our, medical officer of health, what they're telling us to do.
Yeah, and I think we can even go to other portfolios, right? So, you know, a really interesting thing, and again, I'll come, you know, like I'm not a climate scientist, I'm not an environmental policies, but I'm more of someone that's interested in the mechanisms of how we do these things. So, we can talk about you know, climate change policy, right? So if we want to even just, you know, take it away from COVID-19 and talk about more generally, but the same lessons apply, is if we were doing evidence-based policy when it comes to climate policy, some of the actions we're just starting to see nose around in terms of developing municipal climate plans. And I'm so proud of local government for being truly among the vanguards, certainly in Canada, for developing these kinds of tools. But there's been a real hesitancy. And I think that's where exactly what you're talking about in terms of this, the politicization of evidence, you know, who gets to decide what evidence is, and then how does it get incorporated into things? And so we need to find ways to unhinge those things. And this is where we get into that really interesting and complex relationship between the civil service and elected decision makers. And so, you know, the adage across most orders of government in Canada for civil servants is, you know, is fearless advice, loyal implementation, right? So always bringing the best possible evidence and knowledge that you have to the table, and then taking whatever decision is made and implementing that and executing that. So that's where we have this interesting divide there. But something that seems to have happened over time is this reinterpretation of what a mandate for an elected official looks like, and how that correlates to policymaking. And so, you know, our elected decision makers in sort of some of the more, I guess, small c conservative interpretations of how this works would be, you know, to set a mandate, to set a direction, to say these are the priorities and the goals and things we need to look at. And then the civil service is really responsible for the nuts and bolts and the operational side of that, right? But we've seen this increasing overlap now where we have elected decision makers more engaged in the operational day-to-day. We have sort of what I refer to as a sort of a de-skilling of the civil service that is now contracting out a lot of that evidence collection to external consultants. And then so you have this sort of weird disconnect between where is the evidence created and located and analyzed and developed, you know, who's interpreting it and how, and then who's making the decisions on those things. That disconnect is creating that space for exactly what you're saying, this flip-flopping thing. And so we're hard on people, right? As society, we've gotten really, really tough on folks, and rightfully so in a number of cases. But there's a big difference between changing your mind as the situation evolves or as you learn more and saying, look, like this is how I learned, and maybe showing your work, you know, to folks and saying, here's how I came about making this decision, versus the much easier to digest comment of, well, they said this originally and then they said this now and those two are different, so I don't trust you. And somewhere along the line, we've got to figure out a way to show more of the work around that, or to get people interested in following that process. And I understand it, right? Like there's a bit of a fear around that. And there are all kinds of situations where we are right to be critical and to be direct and sort of question how decisions are made. But this disconnect between learning and evolving versus hypocrisy, like those are different things. So how do we unhinge that in people's head? And my thought there is that we're in this interesting opportunity right now where we have a confluence of crises, right? So we have COVID-19, we have the increasing engagement with systemic and structural racism, and, you know, kind of both happening in the shadow of a looming climate disaster, and all of the social and economic consequences of all of those things stewing together, that will require us to learn quickly together in public. And so that shift really can't come soon enough.
I agree. I think it's interesting to see all of these things converge at one time. And what we've kind of witnessed too is this fear, you know, among advisors or policymakers to step away from statements that they made earlier that, you know, might be proven to be a little bit different, you know, as we learn more. And I think that's the context is so important for everything, right? I mean, of course, we want, you know, our public health officials to have confidence in what they are telling us. You know, we want them to be confident and to believe that, you know, they're telling us the absolute best thing they can. However, there is, you know, this sense sometimes that information does change, experience and evidence is changing to suggest something else. And somehow, I feel it says something about our culture that we haven't made a safe enough space for our best minds, our best professionals to say, we've learned more. What we said previously turned out to be flawed. We know more now and we're changing our advice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, you can think about this in any number of varieties. I mean, like, we don't use leeches anymore in medicine either, right? So, you right. know, like, that had to evolve.
Again, mercifully.
Mercifully, you know, thank whatever deity you believe in. But I think that, and yet we laugh at that, right? Like, even statements such as, like, well, you know, I can't believe that we still have debates over the earth being round or flat. So I think that a lot of these things, some of it, is, you know, can be attributed to what some people have called kind of the short 21st century, right? So the speed at which we are learning new things and the amount of information that's available has accelerated to such a point that it can be difficult to discern what is true and what is false and what's changing evidence and how do you react and respond to that. The other bit that's an important part of this conversation, and I don't want to... I'm a critical optimist, which everybody that reads my work would be familiar with, is that, you know, I like to spend a bit of time talking about things that are working, but I do also spend a fair bit of time seeing things that aren't. And I mean, like, so let's talk about the ways in which our policy machinery worked with evidence and did really well with it. So we know we have decades of evidence, almost a century or more of evidence that says you don't restrict your way out of a recession, right? We don't austerity our way out of bad economic times. And so nationally, we saw things like recognizing that the most useful thing that we could do to keep everybody safe was something like the SERP, right? The Emergency Response Benefit, essentially making it possible for people to stay safe and stay home and have a lifeline rather than putting themselves in a dangerous health position or a precarious economic position while we navigate kind of the most immediate shock of what's in front of us. That's good evidence. That's based on both public health and economic evidence and working with them together. When we look at things like recognizing the importance of deferring, exactly as you said, to the medical officer of health, who has the most jurisdiction over this and the most knowledge, and how do we work together to integrate those things? A regional approach to reopening in terms of each province working through what makes sense in their jurisdictions. All of those things based on evidence, and that's really great. Where things are starting to get tricky right now, and exactly as you said, this kind of culture piece around it, is the evidence that we've used before to get ourselves out of difficult social and economic situations changes a bit when the most immediate threat is a virus, right? Is a public health crisis. So, you know, the strategies that we would normally use to navigate difficult times based on evidence, you know, is a lot of investment in public infrastructure, in putting people to work, in getting people good opportunities and appropriate compensation, all these kinds of things, getting kids into school. But all of that changes when those strategies are actually dangerous, right? They're disadvantaged to people's health because you can't do those things. You can't bring people together because that would exacerbate the crisis. So now we're in this position where we have to marry what we know about good, you know, social and economic recovery from a crisis to public health evidence. And this is where it's a good opportunity to kind of pause, where this notion of evidence-based policy or evidence-based care really does come in its largest tradition, at least in the work that I've seen, seems to come largely from the health sphere. So, and that's a lot easier to talk about when we talk about evidence-based care, right? You talk about your doctor who, you know, we know that XYZ treatment works for XYZ ailment replicated over time so many times. And so we know that that's a safe and predictable outcome. That's evidence-based care. When we get into more nuanced and tricky discussions that are about balancing, you know, the individual against the collective, it's not as a direct translation. You can't do kind of randomized trials that way, right? You can't do a control group and a study group and figure out, okay, well, what's happening in this community and what's happening in that community? Unfortunately, to some extent, we're seeing a bit of that happen in the US where we have a different relationship between orders of government and different kinds of interventions where things have been much more cohesive here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think to, you know, to great sadness to observe that happening in the US. But how do we marry those things and move forward is really, really tricky. And so there's been some interesting stuff come out of the Observatory for Public Sector Innovation recently around this idea around sense making and different ways of doing these kinds of processes to address exactly what you're talking about. How do we change some of these cultural perceptions about where to from here, particularly when they're going to involve really challenging conversations that we've not had to deal with maybe in more than three generations, right? There's the comment that well, this is the biggest, you know, government deficit that we've seen since World War II. Well, this is also the biggest, you know, global crisis we've seen since that time. Yes. And so they will be commensurate. And so finding ways to be really careful about the way we frame those things becomes important. But then also recognizing that they provide this important lens of saying normal didn't work for everyone. And we have the evidence that proves that. So how do we develop interventions around those things? And that all plays into this really difficult balance, I think, particularly in North American culture, where we have this notion of the individual versus the notion of the collective. And how do you balance some of your feelings and thoughts around saying, well, that's, you know, that's not my individual case, or that doesn't benefit me directly, versus how your behavior and actions and your buy-in play into the collective experience and the social experience. And so we're trying to develop policy that wrangles with both of those things in an uncomfortable way. So I think that transitioning that culture into one of saying, you know, this is, I heard the best example I heard for this is that, you know, public policy is really just very difficult science fiction. And I love that. I wish I could remember who it was. Someone tweeted it and I thought it was so great because it's true, right?
True.
Yeah, isn't it? So it's yeah. So great, because what we're trying to do through like kind of this long rambling thing that I've just taken you with is trying to chart that into what do we need to do to respond to what's happening right now that will also set us up for some future scenario that we're still not entirely sure of, but that we'd like to get closer to? And then how do we treat that process not as a static thing? And I think for a lot of folks, both inside and outside government, there's the tendency to believe like, well, I made a decision on this policy and that's done and never to be revisited. Well, but that doesn't work, right? Otherwise we'd still be, not wearing seatbelts and having leeches attached to us, you know, like that's, I think, you know, like that's, those are a bit facetious, but you know, the equivalent of those things, right? And what we're seeing, I think, in this tension is this really interesting discord where a lot of people who kind of maybe have the perception that no matter what happens, I'll be fine. No matter what the government decides to do, whatever, I'll be fine. And so I should get to decide over what I do and what I don't do and how I engage with those things, versus this broader push that says, well, my survival is interdependent with your survival. And so policy interventions have to be geared towards that. And so we have this really weird tension between who gets to decide what evidence gets listened to, you know?
Now we're going to take a short break before getting into the rest of the conversation with Ashley Whedon. We want to thank TELUS Smart Traffic Solutions, brought to you by TELUS IoT, for sponsoring this episode. Smarter traffic data for a smarter and safer city. Discover more at telus.com/smarttraffic. Municipal World's executive membership delivers a powerful toolkit for managing Canada's towns and cities. You get the most complete suite of print and online news, plus high-impact communication services and exclusive member content, as well as information to help you and your community stay a step ahead. Executive membership is sized to fit your organization, from 5 to 50 users per membership, and members report saving an average of $1,287 per year just on job postings. It's a smart investment that can quickly pay for itself. Become a member today. Without further delay, let's jump back into that conversation with Ashley Whedon.
I mean, we see this during the pandemic now has really been thrown into the spotlight, particularly as we come further and further away from the early days where people seem to understand the clear and present danger and a little bit more focused on that collective. But the individual interests versus the collective interests, and you know, similarly, we have this difficult, delicate balancing act going on between public health and economic imperatives, and what, you know, the needs of those two things, and how much are we willing to sacrifice one for the other on either side?
Yeah, and I think like this is a great way of framing things, is that it's not either or, right? There's no economy without robust public health, and a healthy economic system helps us support all of these other initiatives. So they're not inseparable from each other. And you know, I think there are unfortunately some narratives going around that that, you know, you increase GDP per capita by reducing the capita. And that's not how any of that works, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what it, I'm not saying that's what people are promoting, but that's without putting that final word, what's the kind of current meme around it? It's like saying the quiet part out loud, right? Like that's essentially what folks that are advocating, you know, well, we need to get back to our lives and things need to function and this is what's happening. Well, at what cost? And so also framing that around not just the immediate threat, exactly as you said, of the virus or of me, you know, individuals catching it or whatever, but the long-term threat of we don't know. So this is where the evidence comes in, is we're starting to learn, but we don't know what the long-term health impacts of COVID-19 have on individuals. Some of the emerging data is quite concerning. We also need to wrestle with the fact that those decisions to go back to work, you know, a friend was saying, you know, her teenage daughter is working in the local grocery store. And, you know, every few weeks they have a bit of a meltdown because, you know, her worst fear is what if I go to work and I do one thing just not exactly right and someone catches COVID-19 and dies, or I bring it home and someone gets really sick. And that kind of trauma and the social cost of that, I think we haven't done enough to talk about in terms of when we're talking about the reopening of schools or the reopening of businesses. And there's been some really interesting things right now. So this again goes to, what do we do with the evidence? So recently we were seeing some upticks in cases among my cohort, right? The 20 to 39. And it was really interesting to see, and even my own personal reaction to that was to put a story into that data that we don't know is there, right? It was just a story that we all collectively made up, which is these young people are partying, they're not following the rules, they're doing all this kind of stuff. How quickly we went to that narrative, which isn't in that data, we don't know that, but we made up our own evidence, right? We made up our own evidence because we've seen some pictures on the news, we've seen some the odd video. But the flip side of that is that that age demographic is also the age demographic that has been called back into a variety of essential and other economic activities. There are people most likely working at your local grocery store, or working, you know, as your server in the bar, or they're teachers or medical professionals themselves. Those are people in the prime of their kind of the economic life. But that wasn't the story we went. That wasn't kind of the evidence we looked for first, right? We looked for evidence of young people being reckless. And so how important it is for us when we're presented with information. This is why evidence-based policy becomes so challenging, is it's very easy to be presented with data and imbue it with a story that may or may not be true. And then when we are operating in a policy context where most senior decision makers are dealing with a level of information and a quantity of information and a quantity of decisions that they have to make that is just astronomical, that you're kind of boiling even very large portfolios down to what somebody called the new thing is not a deck, but a placemat, which is literally kind of an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper where all of your information about a given policy problem fits on that piece of paper. You know, maybe the solution isn't to reduce the context information to a placemat, but is to have more resources so that those decisions, all decisions, are made in a context-based way and made with the full attention that's required for them. And that's not to denigrate anyone. That's just the pressures that we've put on government that is sort of this do more with less and more in terms of decision makings. And psychologically, the evidence shows that we can only make so many decisions in a day, right? That's why there was all of that stuff that came up around certain high achievers, you know, like President Obama only had two colors of suits and it was like a gray suit or a blue suit, you know, because if I don't have to decide on my suit, then that's more brain power I have for other things. And I mean, it sounds silly, but it's actually, it bears out in the psychological science that when we're deciding everything, whether it's your breakfast or the cup of coffee you're going to have or what music you're going to listen to your car, we only have so much decision-making bandwidth in a day. So if we're asking senior policymakers to make huge, important decisions, and they're making a lot of them in a given day, you know, how much are we overextending that? And then how is that advice filtering up to elected officials? You know, this becomes, you know, the idea around the 8-hour long council meeting. Well, that's not effective. We know the evidence is there that says, well, that doesn't actually lead to good decisions, and leads us into that place kind of coming full circle now where we are more reactive, right? We know that about individuals, that if we're, you know, if we're underslept or overstimulated, particularly in times of crises, most people, our capacity for making those decisions gets even smaller. And so we have to be really mindful around all of these subjective filters. So it's that this goes through, because it's not just like someone presents a scientific report. Someone goes, yep, that's great. We're going to do that. That's not how policymaking ever happens. And I don't think I need to tell any of your listeners that that's how it goes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if it was that straightforward? But so we have to be cognizant of all these things, that becomes part of the difficulty. And then finally, you know, in terms of these challenges and opportunities is that we find this case around the evaluation. So did it work, right? Mm-hmm. We go back to that policy and say, how do we know that it did anything? What I like to call like the so what factor. And we are really not great at that as a country, as a province, across the board. Policy evaluation has kind of fallen off. And
it's kind of hard sometimes, though, yeah, right? Because there's this, it's not like you're working in a controlled experiment. No. And sometimes there's correlation between things, but, you know, that doesn't mean causation. So
no,
it's the challenge. Yeah.
I have so much empathy, and this is my thing, is like, you know, having been in the public service, have been outside, you know, all of the criticism that comes from that is said with love, because it is really hard, right? Like, how do you evaluate based on what metrics? What was it intended to do? What problem are we actually trying to solve? And then particularly hard when, you know, it's really easy for some external sectors to government, so some portfolios, whether it's health or whether it's technology or agriculture or whatever, to say, well, we're designing an intervention for this particular subset, when public policy writ large is its very definition is to design things to the general, right? You're not designing for a specific person. And so in some cases, this borrowing of kind of some aspects of user-based design are great because they tend to put people at the heart of it, but they have their limits in terms of broader public policy development that I think we need to be really careful about, because and this goes, you know, back to this problem around learning, is that the way our current policy analysis cycle and way of doing the machinery of government has been built, it largely hasn't changed since, you know, kind of the mid-50s, right? The process through which these things go, and arguably for more than a century before that, the process might have sped up some. It might go through a couple different layers, but this cycle of kind of idea, introduction, when it gets becomes policy, and then it becomes a static rule, and then we come back to it only once that becomes a problem again, continues to be the model. So it's designed to maintain the status quo. So policy innovation in and of itself is a bit of an oxymoron, but we're in a place right now where that's what's being required. And so we have all of this really push and pull factors around how do you make responsive policy? How do you make agile policy? How do you do all these things, which is really just deck chairs on the Titanic. I don't care what you call it. How do we design our ways of doing government and governance that are reflective of our current reality? Needs to be the better question. And then how do we get good data and good information into that process of doing government and governance? And so that's the new interesting tension to me, and gets us into these things around where have we learned this really well? And we do have some case studies of things that have worked really well. And how do we bridge those over so that we can change some of those culture conversations? And we're deep down the nerd rabbit hole now, in terms of that. But it becomes this conversation around how do we want to do government? What does that look like?
I want to thank Ashley Whedon for taking the time to chat with us, and thank you for listening. Please stay tuned for part two, where Ashley shares her thoughts on the dangers of a one-size-fits-all policy, gatekeeping in academic research, and how the rise in populism has affected local discourse. If you'd like to hear more from Ashley, follow her on Twitter at Ashley Whedon. If you found the information in today's episode useful, we hope you'll please drop us a note to let us know, or give us a shout on Twitter at Municipal World. Until next time, I'm Susan Gardner. This is MW Shares. Please stay healthy, stay safe.